I hear there's rumors on the internets.
Greetings from Stockholm, Bratislava, and New York. My name is Henrik.
And I'm David, and you're listening to the Check Your Facts podcast.
So, how are you, David? And what's going on in the Balkans?
You wanted to say Middle Europe, right?
No, my wife is from Bosnia, so all of those countries are the Balkans for me.
Yeah, I guess for the people in the United States, we are still Czechoslovaks and not Slovaks. But hopefully that's changing. Anyway, nothing's going on like super special here. How about you? I heard about the new mobile CMS you launched in your newsroom. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. We sure did. It's a light version of our current CMS, built as a standalone application based on Google's material design. So editors and reporters can do the most basic stuff with it, such as creating and updating articles and teasers, change order of the teasers on a section page, add tags and images to articles, and so on. So I've just finished educating the newsrooms of Dagens Industri and Dagens Nyheter, and now I just hope they'll start using it.
Speaking about mobile CMSs, that's definitely the cue for us to introduce our next guest to the podcast, Sasha Koren. She's the editor at the Guardian's Mobile Innovation Lab in New York City. Hey, Sasha, great to have you here.
Hey, Henrik. Hey, David. It's great to be here.
And kind of ironic, just a little bit, because we promised to cover journalism outside of US and UK, and now we're already introducing a guest who works at the UK-based news organization The Guardian in New York.
Well, hopefully you can get all of the two countries that you didn't, or the areas that you didn't want to focus on, out of the way with me this once, and then you never have to do them again.
Yeah.
We can't promise that.
Probably not. But, you know, we are very glad to have you on the podcast.
Oh, I'm so glad that you
could join us. And so what are your thoughts on mobile CMS, Sasha?
I'm really excited about what you've done there. And I think that it's really important for editors and reporters to have a closer way of working that better mirrors the way that readers are reading. So I'll be very curious, say in a month or two, to get to hear your thoughts on how maybe that's changing their awareness of what they're publishing and whether it changes anything about their perceptions of what users are seeing too. I think all too often you have a mobile CMS, or you have a CMS that's only desktop, or only that you can only use on a laptop, and it's good for speed, and it's maybe good for just efficiency when you're in the office, but as far as actually really relating to how your content might look when it's picked up by someone who's on their mobile phone, it kind of creates a bit of a barrier.
Yeah, I'll definitely report back to you in a month or so when the reporters and editors have really started using it. And my hope is that the editors, when they are out on missions like political press conferences and such, that they will leave the laptops at home, and, you know, instead of calling an editor in the newsroom to give him or her some quotes to add to the article, they can just pull the mobile up and log in to the mobile CMS and add the quote themselves.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So they don't have to call in with a sat phone or use methods that were common in the, you know, 1940s, 1970s, 1990s.
1994, perhaps?
1994. Yes, that's when I started.
Yeah.
Been around for a while, yeah.
Yeah, about that, you know, if we do some... Let's check your background.
Okay.
Sorry, pun intended.
Uh-huh.
Ha-ha. But, You started out as an editorial and program assistant at the New York Foundation for the Arts back in 1994. That's right.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. It was, I mean, 1994, there was an internet, but it wasn't really being commonly used. And I think I didn't even have my first email address in that job. And I think I was lucky because I got, it was, they published a small newspaper for creative communities within New York State, and also gave some funding to arts and education. So I was reporting on a lot of issues that were relevant to sort of government funding and also different kinds of facilities for art spaces in New York. And so I got that good old fashioned skill of sort of, you know, cold calling people on the phone and going out and meeting them in person, and, you know, skills that I think reporters still need, and also editing pieces by other people. So, but I think that I was also hearing that there was about, you know, much more about the internet, and friends of mine worked for companies that produced information on CD-ROM. And so I was really curious, which is why after a couple of years, I moved to take on a job at a technology company, which was a database of music and books and film. It was pre-Amazon, and but would sort of would have been the kinds of databases that would have powered Amazon had Amazon not done it themselves. And they got bought later by different kinds of companies and greater acquisitions. But it was really my first introduction to technology and to the concept of databases and what data could power and how access to information could be spread in a really powerful way. So that ultimately led me to sort of teach myself HTML and get a couple of different kinds of freelance jobs, which gave me more technology skills, like learning how to transfer files over FTP, which I can't even believe I did. I mean, all my technology skills are sort of still, like, you know, relevant, but I also feel like they were very rudimentary at that point, although they seemed very complex. And now, you know, now I think that you probably wouldn't even ever need to know those kinds of things because there are so many tools that kind of can do it for you. Like creating a website off HTML isn't really necessary that much anymore unless you want to do some very custom, you know, custom work, and in which case you want to know CSS and HTML5, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what led me to The Times, which was started publishing its website in 96. And I was there to be a copy editor and to also be a web producer on a small arts and culture section that they were producing for the New York region called New York Today. And then had a bunch of different roles that were always involved in editorial, like figuring out ways to use new technologies to tell stories in the language of that time.
And you were there for like 17 years, right?
Yeah. Just almost 17 years, yeah.
Wow.
I've been saying 16, but then I looked at the dates. Right. It was a long time, yeah. I really grew up there, and I got a lot of different kinds of educations there, and worked with a lot of different departments, worked with the opinion department, and then worked in the newsroom on social media and led the social media and community teams for the last 4 years that I was there. So then I started at The Guardian.
Why did you leave New York Times for The Guardian?
I think when you're at an organization for a really long time, I loved the New York Times. It was my home and my community. And I think that when you're at an organization for a long time, there's certain ways that you get a little bit set in your ways, and you start sort of thinking in ways that are not fresh, even if you have people around you who are thinking in fresh ways, that you can sometimes let yourself get a little bit sort of you accept things as normal that in another place you would see as new, and maybe, or you would approach with fresh eyes and start to challenge. And I just knew I needed a change. I needed, you know, it was either stay there for the rest of my career or, you know, sort of set off. And it didn't hurt that at the time they were offering buyouts, and it was financially a good decision too. It's sort of one of the common stories in American journalism these days is, you know, rounds of buyouts and layoffs, as it probably is in other places in the world.
It's same in Sweden. How about Slovakia? Yeah.
No buyouts here, actually. You get buyouts, you mean you get
paid to leave.
Paid to leave. Well, not really here, because many of the people are like working but freelancing. That's why you don't get a buyout. But if you're working like full time, then you get a buyout, but it's not like a big money.
So you sort of, it sounds like different terms, and it seems like every different country has slightly different labor laws where it comes to journalists, and I know that in the UK it's quite different too, so and they have quite a strong labor union. Anyway, that's a little bit of an aside into newsroom labor law, which I actually am not an expert in at all. So I moved over to The Guardian. It was a great opportunity. I think mobile is such a sort of underexplored in some ways set of parameters to create journalism within. It's clearly where the audience is, and you know, until the next set of devices comes along, this is where the audience is going to be, and that we're not yet really fully taking advantage of that fact. So I thought it was a great opportunity to sort of see what I could do with a small team to sort of help raise awareness of and help push the boundaries of what we consider to be journalism on mobile.
I see. And for the American Guardian, you've got the same editor-in-chief as in UK?
It's it all reports up to Kath Viner, who's the editor-in-chief in the UK, but there's a separate editor who runs the newsroom here, Lee Glendening. We work really closely with the US newsroom. We also have good relationships with the UK newsroom and are in contact with lots of people there for various reasons, as well as the product and technology teams there too, and we've done some collaborations with them.
Actually, I have a question for you, Sasha. Now, your innovation lab is like all about mobile, and in the world when talking about internet and mobile, there is also the question, so is it the future? Is it the apps? Is it the mobile web, or is it the web apps?
That feels like a trick question. I know you don't mean it to be, because it feels like there's no good answer here. I do think that if I was a small organization looking to capture a larger audience, I would probably not invest in an app, a mobile app per se. I might invest in a web app or mobile web, optimizing for mobile web. And the reason I say that is because I think apps are hard to keep people engaged with. They have some great capacity and great features once you're in them. The fact that you can download for offline reading, the fact that you can sort of set some preferences. But I also feel like it's probably a small portion of your actual audience that's going to be fully engaged with that app on a daily basis.
If I
was going to make an argument for an app, though, I would say that, you know, it's good to have an app to sort of keep that audience engage with you in the sense of that you can push them information and pull them back, but I don't think that's the only way.
I thought you were going to say, if you need an app, it should be the Guardian Mobile Innovation Lab app. Well, that's the one app you need.
That's the only app you should ever need. Actually, I would say that's the one app that you might want if you wanted to see some very strange things on the internet that are not necessarily fully realized. For your daily news needs, I would probably send you somewhere else. Yeah, we do have an app that we're using as a way of sort of launching new experiments. And actually, one of our developers is working on a way to code for that app that will work sort of seamlessly with mobile web. So I'm excited about that.
Okay, I guess we can talk about some of the experiments you've done in
sure.
the past year, right? Was it a year
mm-hmm.
already?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's already been a year.
It has. We've been experimenting since May, but the lab has been sort of up and running, and we had to spend some time staffing up and sort of setting our priorities, but we had a team in place by May, and we started experimenting then, yeah.
So
wow,
what?
Okay. So Henry, go on. I know you had a bunch of questions regarding the innovations and the experiments.
Yeah. First, a general question about the experiments, because as you said, like if you have the mobile app, you're gonna see some really weird experiments on the web, and you know that's the thing that amazes me the most with the mobile innovation lab is that I read this post back in, I think it was an article by Neiman Lab in August, I think, when you did an experiment of Chrome notifications.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started to crunch the numbers, because it was like 20% out of this many people, so when I started to crunch the numbers, it was like it was 20 people who signed up for this and
mm-hmm.
for this and used it. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't consider that a bad thing. I was like, this is amazing. This is amazing that we can do stuff like this, because in Sweden, the big media houses are always talking about making money, making profit,
yeah.
you know. A lot
yeah.
of innovations aren't done because you don't have a plan, a strategy for making profit.
Yeah. I think that's one of the really rare and special things about working in the lab, is that we're explicitly not addressing monetization. So our job is to figure out what formats might be appealing to users and where we might need, where there might be more opportunities for newsrooms to take advantage of those formats, and to share that information publicly. That's it. And so when we're experimenting, that gives us a really big latitude to sort of be creative about the ways that we're thinking about new products. And I think that's really unusual within news organizations looking to launch new services and products, is that they're thinking monetization first, rather than, or by and large, they're thinking monetization first, or monetization as a big piece of it, rather than what's going to serve our users well. And then, you know, monetization, I would love to think, will come next. I know that we don't all have the luxury to operate that way. But I do think that, like, you can't sell anything unless you know users are going to be there, right? So so if you can prove out something that's going to be really, really appealing, then maybe the monetization comes on top of that. But I also think it's a really, like, the way that we're working, I think, has a lot of promise for news organizations if they do have a couple of people to spare in starting small and doing small experiments that you can learn a lot from. You know, do something that doesn't have a lot of overhead, get a small audience of 20, 500, 1,000, and see what you learn from them, send them a survey afterwards and see what they say. And we've been able to really learn a lot, both from usage data, but also qualitative feedback that we get from users who say, I loved this, but this didn't work for me. So all of those kinds of signals give us a sense of where the next experiment can maybe do better and what we can hone to sort of figure out where those opportunities are.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's really, I have to say, it's really fun. And knock wood, you know, more opportunities for more journalists will come along like this, because I think they're really interesting and freeing, and will ultimately, you know, if we were not working on a grant that was industry focused and just working on behalf of The Guardian, I think we would be able to say to our, you know, senior management at The Guardian, like, here's a really great opportunity, because we saw, like, you know, 80% engagement off 1,000 people. That's extraordinary, you know, or 80% engagement off any number of people. But, you know, just if there's 80% engagement with 1,000 people, even if that goes down to 60, that's still great.
Yeah.
Sorry, Henrik. I was just like wondering, like, most of your experiments were concerning notifications, right?
They have been up until now, and we started. I co-lead the lab with a product manager whose name is Sarah Schmalbach, and she and I, when we first started, we sat down and tried to figure out, well, where do we think there's a lot of opportunity and where our experiments could be useful, and what are kinds of areas of technology and what are the kinds of formats that news organizations and newsrooms are not yet taking advantage of. And one of the big ones was notifications. We also felt like live coverage needed some rethinking, that most live coverage of events and breaking news was done in a way that was very much built for desktop, which was a live blog, and that doesn't work so well on a mobile device. So where could we make innovations on that? But we started with notifications and experimenting really heavily too with Chrome web notifications, because it didn't require an app. We didn't have an app at that point. So they were easy to use and easy to get going. Mm-hmm. And we did start small. I think our first experiment, we probably did have only about 20 people, maybe more. I'm not remembering accurately, but I'll trust you on that number. But yeah, we did start very, very small and then built up over time until... for the U.S. election, we did a big notifications experiment with the help of the UK apps teams. We built into the Guardian apps a way of getting data on the poll results. So, you know, we had one automated alert that would update with the latest results every time. Every time the new ones came in from the AP, the Associated Press, which is the main organization that reports poll results in the U.S.
Yeah, and also the inauguration, when we could watch a live stream on a lock screen. That was, you know, yeah, I was kind of mind blown, because I had never even thought about it.
Yeah, it's something actually, that's really... Yeah, go ahead.
No, sorry. I just wanted to, like, this is the first time anyone has done that, right? Like, live video in notifications.
First time that we know of, yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
I think Mike, the US publication, Mike.com, they've already done, they have pushed video into notifications, right? That was, like, sometime last year.
They have. They've started, so... When iOS 10 launched in late September, I think, they added the capacity to have video and photos within a notification, and GIFs. So I think that Mike was the first to really take advantage of that and make a big splash on that. But live video just seemed like it was a really good opportunity to explore, and for something like an inauguration, which has a very sort of predictable set of events going on, for the most part, that it would be something fairly easy for us to do. So we explored it again with the help of a lot of different people from The Guardian, actually, from the video teams and from the apps teams in the UK. And we were able to get a live stream into a notification. So hopefully other people will sort of see the advantage of that and see the interest in that and follow on and maybe steal that work. So not steal it, but, you know, take it on and be inspired by it.
Borrow it. Yeah. And, you know, as you said, like, the users are very interested in notifications and these kind of experiments. Another thing, you know, in these post-election days, everyone is still talking about fake news and filter bubbles. And The Guardian has launched this Burst Your Bubble. And I don't know if you have had time to check it out, but actually this week, Nick Lum's new crowdfunded app, Read Across the Aisle, were launched.
I haven't seen it, but I've seen mention of it, and I'm really interested in it.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool initiative. I have to say that I backed it. I downloaded the app when it was released. I'm not that impressed yet, but I think there's a lot of potential.
It's a Kickstarter project?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Exactly. Kickstarter project. So it was fully funded this week, and I think it was like Monday it was released to the public, the app. You know, I mean, it's free for everyone to download, so you could just download it in the App Store.
And can you just repeat the name so that people can
yeah,
if they didn't get it the first time?
Yeah, the app is called Read Across the Aisle.
So it's in ISLE.
No, as in ISLE. So the app is about, like, they have these sources like Wall Street Journal and Fox News, which are Republican sources, and then they have Democrat sources, so to speak, like the Huffington Post and etc. And then you have this gauge, which is on one end it's blue, and then it gets lighter blue, and then it gets light red, and then red in the other end. So when you are reading articles, this gauge shifts depending on what kind of sources you are reading. So if you're reading a lot of Republican sources, you will end up on, you know, the far right of the gauge, of the bar, so to speak.
Hmm. It sounds like a really effective way of sort of making you realize sort of the potential bias of what you're reading.
Yeah, I have never even thought about, you know, I don't really consider American news outlets as either Republican or Democrat, except for like Fox News, because people are always making jokes about it. But, you know, I wasn't aware of the fact that Huffington Post is kind of very liberal, democratic, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it is more so now. I mean, I think this is such a big topic of conversation within U.S. journalism circles, because I don't think that, you know, most news organizations, most U.S. news organizations necessarily identify as one thing or the other. But with this election, a couple of really significant things happened. One was, we had a candidate who was sort of openly discrediting news organizations that pride themselves on careful and ethically reported and ethically edited journalism, calling them fake and liars and et cetera, et cetera. And that's only continued as he's been president. And so that creates a big challenge, and also maybe, you know, the perceptions of what, as the phrase goes, mainstream media is within certain parts of the country is that it is biased, and that it isn't taking into concern the sort of way that many people within the population think and live their lives. And I think that's a huge challenge for, or a huge set of challenges for organizations to confront. I don't even know what mainstream media is. And I say this having worked at an organization that considers itself, you know, a general interest publication. It's wants a very broad readership. I think the hope was, and the assumption has been, if we create journalism in the best and most professional way we know how, readers will appreciate it and readers will come. And that in retrospect is a bit of a luxury. So now I think new people who are interested in news and people who are interested in the way news is read now, especially with the rise of Facebook, which has been so effective at sort of like filtering people's experience of news in particular ways, whether or not it's by credible sources or not, is to burst, you know, to sort of get out of this thinking of like, if we create news just in the way we always have, then it will be read. I think journalism is, or U.S. journalism is sort of realizing we need to do more to connect with potential audiences. And I think that's a positive thing. I think it was a hard reason to have to learn it. But it's something that I've sort of believed in for a long time, and it's nice to see it sort of coming to fruition, even if in this hard way. Sorry, I'm talking so much about U.S. media here in your European-centered podcast.
Yeah, so
that doesn't matter. Let's just maybe get back to your like what are your plans for like the future?
Yeah, we right now, so we're experimenting so much with notifications, and we're going to continue that, but we're also adding into that, as I mentioned, the consideration of live news and sort of looking at how to present different kinds of live news experiences to mobile readers in ways that might make the stories easier to understand or make the threads easier to sort of follow. Like, you know, if you have, we did one small experiment for the inauguration, and then another for the Super Bowl here in the U.S., the big American football championship, where we took different parts of the story and put them in different panes, so you could swipe back and forth between the panes. For the Super Bowl, it was, and that experiment is still up. I can send you a link.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I'll send it to you after. But you could see what was going on for the official game, and then what was happening with the halftime show, which was Lady Gaga. And also for the advertisements, which were a pretty big deal in the U.S. A lot of companies release their new ad campaigns for the Super Bowl, or do you think clever things, or do things that are very impactful. So it was basically everything that was going on the field, and then everything that was not sports. Because you also get quite a number of people who are interested in sports but don't really care about the halftime show or the ads. And vice versa, you get people who really, like, really want to see Lady Gaga but don't care about football. So that's one thing we're trying out, and then we're also going to look more into video and what we can push there. And a couple of the two other areas of focus that we're starting to sort of think about how to stand up in an experimental way are something that we call contextual delivery. So meaning, you know, taking advantage of the sensors and the related sets of permissions that are embedded in devices. such as location or access to your contacts, which is a very sensitive one, but could have some advantage. To sort of deliver you a better news experience. So, you know, if we know that you are commuting between 7 a.m. and 7:30, that we can create a little package for you, you know, for offline reading or audio consumption. Or if we know that you have just landed in the London airport and you need the schedule of the next train into London, or you would like sort of an update of what has recently happened in London that, you know, might be of interest to you, or of sort of arts and culture experiences that you might want to take advantage of while you're there.
What about VR and AR?
VR and AR we're not working on. Only we made a pretty conscious choice before we started, when we started, to not take those on. One, because we felt like they took a lot of expertise and a lot of financial capital to sort of play around with. And two, because the audience isn't there in mass numbers yet. Yeah. It's not something that you're going to pick up every day.
And maybe also like The Guardian already is building a VR lab in the UK, right?
It's
headed
VR
by staff. Francesca Panetta, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah. And so I do think it's important for news organizations to experiment to the extent that they can, or for journalism to have a presence in the VR landscape. So I think it's really interesting, and it's only going to develop and get more. The equipment's going to get cheaper and it's going to get more frequent. But I think it's a whole other set of challenges than we're seeing right now, and the day-to-day consumption of news is still within the small device and looking at it sort of while you're walking around, or while you're sort of conscious of other, you know, it's not as fully immersive. So that's where we're focusing for now.
That sounds very interesting. And since it's already past noon in New York right now when we're recording this, yeah, so I guess that you're sort of craving for lunch.
I'm getting there. Yeah, I'm starting to think of the options.
Yeah. And
it's not going to be pizza today, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, always sorry to say that it won't be pizza. I love
pizza.
Well,
if you come visit New York, I will take you all to pizza.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. We will take you up on that someday.
Absolutely.
Well, if we will be allowed to enter the country, of
course. that might be another hour-long conversation.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh yeah. I would say more.
So, David, would you do the honor of asking the very last question to Sasha?
Yes. Actually, I have to sum it all up. So you publish everything you do in your experiments. Will there be like a comprehensive study or something you will put out after all this ends, or will be there some stats for people, or some like best practices to draw on for other organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. We're working on a couple of things, and one is sort of ways of making what we've learned, distilling them into sort of more actionable insights. So we're looking to potentially publish some sort of specific recommendations and documentation. One of the requirements of the lab from the grant was that we work in the open, which is a very, very much in line with the Guardian philosophy, and to make things open source. And so I was really excited about it when I started, and then I realized how hard it is actually to do. And so, you know, to make things useful to people in ways that they can learn from, but also maybe take into their organizations, is actually when you're doing sort of very specialized experiments that are not taking into account monetization, particularly to make some, to make that impact and to make the sort of possibilities known, isn't as easy as I thought it would be. And then sort of doing that while you're actively experimenting. So we're still, we want to make it sort of easier and what we produce to be usable by other organizations. And then we're also working with the Tau Center for Digital Journalism, which is here in New York at Columbia University. And they have a research group that we're working on a couple of different topics that we will sort of have produce a body of research with them later this year. And hopefully the grant lasts through the end of the year, and hopefully at the end of the year we will sort of be able to sort of wrap it up with by producing a big study that we'll probably release with Tau, that we'll be able to say this is where we are with mobile journalism in 2017.
That's amazing. You know, it's
Wow, thank you.
It's very nice that you're pioneering here with a mobile innovation lab. And
yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and I hope it will be, and I hope we can be useful to people too.
Oh, you already are.
Oh, good.
Extremely helpful. Absolutely.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I love reading those blogs and then just going to my editors and saying, "Ah, oh, we should do more with this, you know, with these notifications. Maybe that's something we can explore furthermore. Just look at the Guardian, what they are doing."
Well, that's great to hear. That's great to hear. I'm really happy that those conversations are happening and that, you know, we've had a hand in helping people think forward.
Yeah. And we are very happy that you wanted to talk about it with us in the Check Your Facts podcast. So
it was a pleasure.
Yes, very happy. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah.
You're so welcome.
Thanks. I guess that's it for today, David.
Yes, definitely. Big thanks to Sasha. I mean, I would clap, but that wouldn't be great for the listeners.
Yeah. And if you're curious about the Mobile Innovation Lab, you should visit the official blog at medium.com, and you should also download the Mobile Innovation Lab app on iOS and Android. It's the only app you need, according to Sasha.
Yeah, just type
maybe
in
one or two others.
Just look for the Guardian Mobile Innovation Lab. And yeah, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever you find us. Our website is checkyourfacts.eu. That's EU like European Union. Yeah, that thing Donald Trump says he will take apart. And hopefully not.
Yeah, and you should also subscribe to our newsletter, because our goal is to blog about new episodes and the making of this podcast and some useful tips and tools.
So, see you next time, and until then, just don't forget to always check your facts. Big thanks to Sasha Koren from the Guardian Mobile Innovation Lab.
Yeah, big thanks.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Oof. Hey, that's a wrap.